everyone. This is Dr. Brian Hutchison, and welcome to Behind the Science of Career Development, the podcast for the Asia Pacific Career Development Journal. This is episode 2. We successfully made it through one episode so far. And today I'm really excited to talk to two guests who were part of a team of 6 who had the lead article in volume 2, issue 2 from September 2019. The name of their article is "It Takes a Village, Meet the Singapore Career Development Tribe." Now, I want to talk about the other authors before I introduce our two special guests today. So in addition to Yvonne Kong Ho, who is with us today, and Jeremiah Wong, the other 4 authors were Andrew Err, Clarissa Hall, Gerald Tan, and James Tan. And they are already smiling at me because of my mispronunciation. No, I'm actually getting some thumbs up on the screen right now. And so, so I'm really excited today because we have this amazing opportunity to take a look at a country who, you know, in many ways is the center of the career development universe for APCDA. And we're going to talk a little bit about that later. But first, welcome Yvonne and Jeremiah.
Hello.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah,
my pleasure.
And so I'm trying to start some entry traditions to this podcast. And so Yvonne, turning to you, how do you typically describe yourself professionally to other people?
I always say that, you know, I'm a workforce developer. I look at issues that might affect the workforce because I'm a firm believer that we can work and we can take on a cradle-to-grave approach as we work. I really, really believe that, you know, a child as young as 3 years old can be taught and brought up to know and understand that work is precious, work is valuable, work is not tedious. You know, you can find what you want to do and enjoy it, you know, for a very long period of time. So, you know, I remember when my children were very young, they asked me, "Mommy, why do you want to go to work? Why are you going to work?" I said, "Oh, I work because I enjoy my work and I can use my work to add value and to serve people." So that's how we can actually build in the idea and the concept of work to a young child. And here I am now, I'm actually working at a university in Singapore where I look at workforce development issues. I firmly believe that, you know, at the university scene is one of the best times of a young person's life to teach the young person certain very important values and skills and ethics before the person goes out to the workforce to create an impact for people.
Wow. Wow. So other than the fact that I may not need any coffee this morning because that was so motivational, you may be the first person in my fairly long career that identifies as workforce development, but your natural focus is really on children. Do you find that you're unique in your voice, that's where you naturally go, Yvonne?
That's a very interesting question that you have raised, because throughout my entire career, I actually started my career as a special needs teacher for very young children. Then I moved into young people, where I trained them in relationship management skills, communication skills. Then I moved to corporate training, where I worked with adults. And I went to a university and I started my entire career in career development. And guess what? I'm doing a PhD in gerontology, the study of old age. So, you know, I always tell my friends that I've come full circle. I started my career with very young people, very young, like 3, 4, 5 year old, you know, I'm sorry, 3, 4, 5 year old children, all the way to now where I actually interview people who are in their 60s and why do they still continue to work so happily and so joyfully. So I would say that, you know, certainly and really, it's a cradle to grave approach. Brian, you know, Jeremiah, I think you will resound with me, right? And resonate with me.
Oh, yeah.
Work can be so precious. Work gives dignity, work gives you the impetus to live your life purposefully.
Yeah, yeah. Shout out to PhD students out there. Where are you getting your PhD, Yvonne?
I'm doing my PhD with the Singapore University of Social Sciences, where I have 3 of the best gerontology professors in the region guiding me. Okay, on a side note, I owe them a lot of work, but I will do my best to submit.
Do I need to write a letter to your advisor to get you out of class for this?
Can you just ask them to give me a PhD, please?
Oh my goodness. So Jeremiah, same question to you. Yeah. How do you describe yourself professionally to others?
Oh, you know what? I'm just downstream from where Yvonne is from the university to the adults, and the people who are moving towards retirement and the last stage of their career. So in a, as a professional, I would say that as a career practitioner first, and then as a workforce development specialist, I look at to help Singaporeans to manage a lifetime of career transition, career learning, and of course, most importantly, enjoying life. So I think where I came from, Workforce Singapore, this is the stat board, the government stat board that is responsible to keep our local workforce on the bleeding edge. So we want to also ensure that our people will have careers, will have jobs, and of course, especially in such a climate of COVID-19. So and this is also a very important period for career development to soar, because you know, what better time than to talk about career development, especially when people's career are at risk, where people can take the opportunity to review and to rethink how they want to take their career forward.
And Jeremiah, that reminds me of some offline conversations that you and I have had. One of the trainings I do is called, for career professionals, is called Uncenter Work to Recenter Life. And I heard that in what you were saying. I think as a profession, during my time in the profession, we've sort of separated career services away from life services. And I think, was Mark Savickas bringing life design into the lexicon? But can you talk a little bit more on your philosophy for how career is basically just a fertilizer for good life?
I would love to talk about that. You know, career to me is life. Similar to what Yvonne shared, from the cradle to the grave, you know, it's about enjoying your life the way it's meant to be. And you know what some of the factors that intermingle, interweave with our lives. Work is one of the component. Being at any one time, someone is a father to someone, is a husband, is a son myself, or is a civil servant like myself, or even for example for some people there's a best friend of another besties outside. And you know, as we progress in life, many roles that we take across the society, it influences and it changes the perspective of life, how we view work. And you know, Brian, the way you say it just now, how we uncenter work, you know, that is so important, because you know, in Asia, I think we pride ourselves a lot of work, and we work really hard. And when it comes to family, when it comes to mattering, you know, looking at behavior, I think Brian, you spoke about that, behaviors that matters to people around us. So that is really something that I hold dearly as a career practitioner. And I make it a point. I make it a point when I serve my clients, I want to not just address career as a separate vehicle of income generation, but more importantly, from Savika's point of view, life design, what does it mean to you? So yeah, that's my philosophy of what I do.
I really want to say that, you know, I enjoyed Jeremiah's recent submission of the master's dissertation that he did. He just completed his master's recently. I had such a good time reading the dissertation. And Brian, I think, you know, he'll be more than happy to share this with the listeners of this podcast. He spoke about his passion, you know, for career development for many people in Singapore. Such a good read, such a dignified read, I have to say.
Yeah. Well done, thanks, Jeremiah. Yvonne.
Yeah. Thanks, you.
And Jeremiah and I have talked a little bit about his dissertation, and the only thing standing between him and talking about it more on this podcast is publishing it in the journal, because that's what this podcast is, and we've actually talked about that. So I'm excited to see his submission sometime soon.
Thank you, Wolf.
So I do want to pivot then and talk about this article. You know, as an editor, when this manuscript at the time came across my desk, it initially is different, right? It's a unique type of manuscript because it's not a quantitative study. It's not a qualitative study. It's not a practice study. It's not a theoretical article, right? And so I was really excited not only to review it, and then when we decided to accept it, the editorial team, but to really highlight it as the lead article in the issue, because there's something exciting about capturing the development of a profession in a country at a moment in time and almost putting it in a time capsule. And won't this be a wonderful reference in 10 years or 20 years when there's still a vibrant career development profession in Singapore to look back on? So I'm really curious, you know, one of the things I always like to start with is the story behind the article. Who would like to tell the story of how this idea for an article came to be?
You know, right, you know, the inception of this article really didn't come overnight. We the team, the writers, you know, Yvonne, myself, Gerald, Andrew, and Clarissa, and James, we were first inspired by Roberta North. And it was her presentation, it was her speech, it was her work on how she envisioned career development taking taking center stage to improve the lives of Singaporeans in 2018, 2 years ago, when Singapore we had our very first conference on career development, and she spoke about, you know, the important role of the entire career development ecosystem, from the schools to the various institute of higher learning, how the baton was then handed over to workforce, myself, and the union playing a concerted role to help our people make the best of their career. And it was from that presentation by Roberta that really got us thinking. And it was one dinner, you know, Yvonne, correct me if I'm wrong, it was at one dinner, and Roberta was saying, you know what, guys, why don't you guys write a paper on this? And we were all, I still remember, we all seated across that table and we were like, looking at each other, it's like, yeah, I mean, what's stopping us from doing it? And I think, and Gerald was the point man. I call him the point man. He was the guy who brought us together and said, you know what, guys? You know, if there hasn't been a journal to describe the overview of career development growth in Singapore. And just nice, on that table, we have representatives from every facet of the system. We had a school career counselor. We had a university career counselor, Yvonne. We had a union, James. We had a government, myself. We had a private sector, Gerald and Clarissa. And you know what? It's so befitting. Everything just fell in place, waiting for something to happen. Yvonne, what do you think?
I clearly remember that dinner. We brought Roberta after, you know, out for dinner after the conference. I remember it was this Penang restaurant, you know, Peranakan food. We were actually eating dessert. That means we were towards the end of the dinner. And when, you know, Roberta just encouraged us and said, you should write something for the next conference. I want to be very honest. I think we're all in a bit of a food coma. Too much food. It was a buffet. And then we're eating dessert and it was cold and sweet and, you know, coconutty, milky. And I remember looking at everyone and said, you know, and I was very pleasant about everything. I was like, yeah, Roberta, we could consider it, you know. And then we ate and ate and ate. And in my heart, I was like, oh my gosh, you know, we have never, you know, done this before, right? But Jeremiah was right. You know, he pointed out that everyone, you know, were actually representing a particular sector in the entire system. And Gerald, after that, actually immediately started this WhatsApp group for all of us and said, hey, guys, I think we could really consider something like this. We could really come to present and write a paper. And then we'll aim to present it. And he was really, really fast. He was like the project manager. He gave us the deadline. And he said, okay, you know what, James, you write this part. Jeremiah, you write this part. Yvonne, you write this part. And then I'll write this part. And then Andrew will write this part. And guess what? You need to submit to me at this deadline. And we're like, okay, guess what? This is getting real. And I remember, you know, emailing and telling Roberta. And I said, Roberta, she's like our godmother. I must tell you, she's like the godmother for all of us. And I said, I think we are so serious about what you said. We are really doing it. And she said, yes, I'll be speaking at a conference as well in Vietnam. We're all going to meet one another. So everything just felt very nicely, like a jigsaw puzzle. The dinner, Roberta, you know, encouraging us, Jairo setting up that WhatsApp group, and then Jairo coming in to give us deadlines, and then he put everything together. We submitted, it got approved, and guess what? We presented. It was such a dream come true because the entire system came together. And I think what was really heartening to see, as well as to know, was that at the conference last year in Vietnam, a lot of people who sat in our presentations, you know, actually said that, you know, it's so heartening to see Singapore so united.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's not easy to see the entire system coming together, but all we want, and, you know, I would say the fruit of this system is that we just want Singaporeans to have a chance at, you know, their career aspirations, bring their dreams to education. I think that that was really the common thread among all of us.
Yeah.
And I just want to, in case there are listeners who don't know, the person that we're constantly referencing is Roberta Nault, who's from Canada. She's the owner of a career consulting company called Life Strategies, and has, whatever country you're listening from, has probably led and done career work in that country. She's been doing this a long time and is someone that I think many of us look up to quite a bit. Now, I want to be sure, so had any one of the six of you written a peer-reviewed academic publication before, or is this a first time for the whole team?
This is the first time for the entire team.
Yeah, first time for the entire team.
Congratulations.
I presented something before in Beijing, you know, 1 year before Vietnam, but I've not published anything yet in a journal. So when Brian approached us, you know, we were very, very heartened. Thank you so much for the opportunity. Really, it's almost like meeting the dream editor that you want to meet at a conference, and you said,
"Oh yeah, man,
it's really good. You know, you should really consider publishing it in the journal." And then when I told Jairo this is like a dream come true, he said, "Wait a minute, please tell me how does this publishing game work?"
Yes.
I think we all realized how favored we were, so we really want to thank you for the opportunity.
Well, thank you, Brian.
And I don't want to pivot too much, but I think this is a great moment for you to be a role model for other listeners. The Asia Pacific Career Development Journal, we're very unique in the academic profession where we as an editorial team decided to take on a mentor model to publication. And part of that's to build more capacity for quality scholarship that's published in English, right? There's plenty of quality scholarship in individual countries in their language. But for a one region English language journal, we really wanted to do something innovative and unique. So part of the mentorship model is seeking out authors who have potential and they don't know it yet. Working with authors through multiple revisions. And I think you skipped a part of the story. How many revisions did you have to go through before it was published? You made it sound like you wrote it and then it got published next. Did we skip something?
Okay. I mean, there were really quite a bit of revisions, you know. Brian, you know, thank you so much for being so patient with us. I would be honest that I'm thinking of at least 10 to 12 revisions.
Yes.
The whole bouncing and all. Yeah.
Easily.
So that's an important part of the process. So I think what a lot of people who haven't published before academically, I haven't written anything for publication that hasn't gone through at least 8 to 12 revisions. But a lot of, you know, when we write for sort of popular press, for a blog or a newspaper, it's not that same process of revision that it is for science, right? So you've gone from being a communicator to the public to a group of people who have added to science. And I think science should require a lot more, right? A lot more vision and a lot more thought. So, so we've dedicated to working with authors, and this is the role I get to play, to go through multiple revisions before it's submitted for the blind peer review. I then take myself out of the decision-making process of whether or not it gets published because I'm so biased and invested because I've worked with the authors for so long. And I think that's important because the people that are listening that might think, I shouldn't, or I'm not able to publish in this type of journal, you really can. And your group is a perfect example of that. But it's not easy. Yvonne.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. I want to be honest that, you know, Brian, you were always very encouraging, though I have to be honest, some of the pieces of feedback that you gave already, you know, made me at moments think that, okay, this article might not make it. Yeah. But you gave very constructive feedback. You really tightened a lot of things for us. You gave us feedback on, you know, the formatting or even the tabling or how to, you know, make the information more succinct. And then when it went into the peer review, that was when I realized that, okay, guess what? It really wasn't too bad an article, but then even more constructive feedback came back. Yes. Yeah, which I think was very helpful for all of us to see what we do from another pair of eyes, you know, through different professional lenses. I think all of us in this process grew professionally because, you know, we are so deeply vested into what we do, right? So when a person who's reviewing the article actually gave us certain pointers, that was so helpful. That was really, really such a good, you know, process of growth. Although it was a little painful, truth be told, you know, but yeah, our hearts could take it.
Yvonne, and it'll be a good practice for your dissertation.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, so I think at some point we actually have to talk about the article. And again, the goal here isn't to sort of make this a science report. So again, I always think about narrative stuff. Like, so if you were to tell the story of this article, what does this article communicate about career development in Singapore? And actually, maybe as a pre-question, are there any specific cultural components of Singapore that the listener would need to know about to fully understand the development of professional career services?
Oh, I think, I'll bring a few points. Yvonne, do that in as well. So I think the first cultural working at the background is that, you know, being Asians, we are a collectivist society. And, you know, and with that comes the value, the philosophy, and the behavior of working together, of coming together collectively to strengthen our common ethos. So, and with this ethos, we are able to then decide, you know, what works best for our society, what works best for the respective groups of the entire society, be it from the low-wage industry to certain minority groups in society. And then finally, as an institution, you know, how do we come together? How do we need to consider, does this action, how will this action impact the health and the condition of another side of society? For example, in Singapore, we really support the government. We rally behind the government very closely, and one of the spirit that we spoke about as a culture in our paper is this thing called the tripartite movement. So the tripartite movement basically refers to how three parties in Singapore, the union, the business, or, you know, the employers, and as well as the government, comes together collectively to work for the good of the people. And the union, the government, and the business people, they will come together, and from a career development lens, how can we help people from, as Yvonne shared, from the cradle to the grave? And since 2014, we have been moving towards providing career guidance and counseling from the moment people enter school and right up to, you know, the time where you are about to retire. So today we have throughout the entire process, we have career services across different levels. You know, even it doesn't matter if you're in university or you're not able to make it into university, you get career guidance. Mm-hmm. And so that is the first principle, collectivism. The second one is that I would say that, you know, we really revere our family, the people, you know, as individuals. We really, if you look at our most recent budget and our election, a lot of talk has been about helping people to strengthen the social fabric. And one of the ways to help people to strengthen themselves and the social fabric is to create jobs, is to ensure that we have jobs and we help people to get meaningful jobs. I mean, of course, you know, with the COVID-19 situation, we know what the effects that it has around the world. So the government really pay attention to the people's life, the family. And I think this is important. We have always supported the family fabric. So that is the two cultural lenses that I think we can take note of. Yvonne, I'm not sure if there's anything else you want to add.
I just wanted to add one last point. I think one of our deputy prime ministers, Mr. Tharman Shanmugaratnam, he's actually shared in a public forum that Singapore doesn't have a safety net, but we have a trampoline. Meaning, if you choose to jump, the government is going to support and bounce you up. So in Singapore, like what Jeremiah mentioned, the social fabric is very, very important. Yeah. We're all about creating jobs so that you can support your family, you can support yourself. So the idea is that you must actually take the first step out to say that I need help, I need a job. Because once you do that, there's so much support from the government. Mm. And the government will not leave you in the lurch. There's plenty of schemes that, you know, Jeremiah, Gerald's, I would say statutory boards have worked so hard to get everything up for people. So I love the trampoline analogy. We are here to help, but you must start jumping first. And then the government is going to support you up.
And I feel like in my visit to Singapore, like I see that. I see that investment in career development as a part of the fabric. I think a unique component that many listeners from other countries and cultures may not clearly understand easily is the presence of trade unions in Singapore. Could you give just a brief 2-minute review of how unions became such an important part of your culture? And then the role that they play, because I think many countries don't have employee unions. And then in other countries, I would say the United States is one where the unions are often seen as in conflict with employers, not in collaboration.
Mm. Thanks, Brian. You know, the brand and the function of the union, I think as you accurately mentioned, really differs around the world. In fact, as part of my master's, I was comparing the unionists across the world, from Norway to the Scandinavian, and then the US, British, and back to here in Singapore. So I would say that while I don't represent the union in Singapore, let me just share from my experience, having been in the union, an employee of the union for 2 years. Now, the brand of union in Singapore really started from our forefather. In fact, the founder of Singapore, which is Mr. Lee Kuan Yew, he himself is at the forefront of speaking out and standing for the union, fighting for the welfare and growth and career progression, upskilling, since the days that when he was really standing for election under the People's Action Party. And throughout the time when Singapore was in its infant days as a very young nation, and to those of our listeners here, Singapore, this in less than 6 days, 7 days time, in fact, night, we will be celebrating our 55th year old. So as you can see, as compared to the US or some of the longest, oldest country in the world, we are not even 100 years old, and where the journey that we came from, union has played a role to ensure that when industries come into Singapore, when companies set up their presence in Singapore, the union in Singapore, under the leadership and guidance of our minister, Mr. Lee Kuan Yew, he ensures that the people do not get left behind. So of course there are different perspectives and critics of how union is in Singapore. But one thing that we stood out, number one, is that we fought for the ongoing upgrading, upskilling. We provide for funds to the workers to ensure that it's not just to stay in a job. It is good to have a job. We'll do that for you. But what is really more important, as Yvonne shared earlier, is to ensure that you remain employable for a lifetime. So while I'm not a union member, I think this is where this is what they certainly do for Singapore.
So, and I think both of you know that a lot of my work is in diversity and social justice and career, as well as mental health. I'm wondering, in my mind, I can make the connection to where having a collectivist and or a heavily unionized society where the work situation for women might be improved versus other countries that don't have some of those structural components. And I don't mean to put you on the spot. This wasn't a question that we had agreed on, but would you see a connection there between workplace opportunities for women in Singapore and the culture and the union? Is that something that one of you could speak to?
That's an interesting question that you're posed. You know, I honestly have never felt that as a woman in Singapore, I've been deprived of opportunities. Yeah, I've always felt that there is an opportunity for me. I've never really felt slighted. Yeah, I've read Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lenient, and you know, as much as there is a glass ceiling, I've always thought that there's also a sticky floor syndrome. And sometimes in my career coaching book, especially, you know, the pro bono career coaching book that I do, where I don't speak to, you know, young undergraduates or graduates, I speak to women who have been out of, you know, a job for a long while because they chose to be caregivers, they chose to stay home to take care of the family, or they chose to, you know, because they were in ill health and they came, you know, they are trying to come back. That is when they have a lot of preconceived notions that, oh, I can't do this, you know, it's been 20 years, I don't know how to use Excel, I don't know how to use PowerPoint. And, or some of them would say that, oh, I'm too old, or I don't speak good English, or I am this, I'm that. I found that there's a lot more sticky floor syndromes in Singapore rather than glass ceilings. But having said that, I also want to be honest that, you know, there's this big thing that I'm very, very, very passionate about. It's called career capital. Yeah, and career capital is made out of this framework, knowing how, knowing whom, and knowing why. So I've always looked at a lady's career in particular. Yeah, and I think you will agree with me that we can have the knowing how. We can be very good at what we do. We can be very sure what we want, the knowing why. But I think it's the knowing whom that can open a lot of doors. Social capital. Yeah. So that is why sometimes when I speak to, my friends in LinkedIn, you know, they tell me that LinkedIn, it's actually a very good platform because it gives all of them equal opportunities to seek out mentors, to seek out opportunities, job opportunities, developmental opportunities, courses, you know, regardless of their gender, their educational qualifications. Yes, Brian.
So I just want to take a pause for the listener to define terms. So the glass ceiling, as I think about it, is typically, you know, since the feminist movements in the 20th century, the promotion of women into the workplace and a striving for ideas of equality, but that because of the historical drag of men dominating work for all of human history, that there was a glass ceiling, a place where a woman, regardless of her merit, abilities, or experience, would bump up against it and not be able to become the next promotion, the next CEO, the next CEO. Yvonne, could you give sort of a short definition of what you mean when you say the sticky floor?
No problem. So what I define to be the sticky floor after reading Sheryl Sandberg's book is that, you know, let's say I'm a woman, you know, and I'm, for example, in a certain role, I want to go up, I want to rise, I want to be promoted, I want to be recognized for what I can bring to the table, but I am the one actually who decides that there are certain conditions that have made me unable to move up. I chose to stick onto the floor, you know, almost like a, you know, a lizard on the floor, very sticky, right? And I said, I can't move because my kids are too young. I can't move because my husband's agreed to me moving overseas for a 2-year posting. I can't move because, you know, this workplace is very convenient for me to pick the kids up, to work, as well as to, run errands for my family. Yeah, I can't move because this industry is foreign to me and I don't think I have time at night to do, you know, an additional certificate to go for another role. Yeah, I do see that. I do understand, you know, that sometimes when I coach women, I do understand that there are phases in their lives where they have to be more visible and more present at home. For example, when the children are young or when there is a parent that's not well, yeah, that's when, yes, they might not be able to move. They might have to stay in that phase of their life for a while. Yeah. So when my young graduates sometimes ask me, Miss Yvonne, can you have it all? Can a woman have it all? Mm. You know? And I will always tell them that there is no perfect answer, but I always believe that you can have it all, but may not be all at one time. Mm. At different phases of my life, I chose to be more visible at home and more present at home. I gave up opportunities that would have given me opportunities to travel overseas, but I wanted to be the one to put my kids to bed. And that is the decision that I chose to make because I want to be present for the children. So, you know, to your question about whether women are given opportunities in Singapore, yeah, it really depends on how you define the situation.
Yeah, and before moving on, I also think of is the opportunity equally there for women or for any other marginalized group, but also to have the equal opportunity, is there an additional social burden? And I think that gets into the capital part that you were talking about. If there are still, for example, I think what you're saying is if there are still, for example, additional expectations of women at home and the family, sure, you can become the CEO, but you have to do it at a higher burden cost because of those familial expectations. And so I think when we think about equality, it's not just equality of opportunity. Can you become the CEO? But how is society structured so that the burden to pursue opportunity we're trying to strive to make that more and more equal as well. Did I summarize okay what you were saying, Yvonne?
You definitely did, Brian. I have a very wise mentor who taught me that, you know, in life there are rubber balls and there are crystal balls. Yeah, and at different seasons of our career, you know, there are some balls that we can allow to let drop because it will bounce back.
Yep.
But there are some balls that we let slip, you know, is really a crystal ball and you won't be able to pick up, you know, all the bits. And that same mentor also taught me that, you know, we must never be a public success but a private, success but a private failure.
Yeah.
You know, you're absolutely right. You know, women can choose to be the CEO, but at what cost? And are you willing to put that cost?
Yeah. So I want to sort of just check in one more time on the article before we start to wrap up. You know, I come to Singapore, I work with people, I talk to you all the time. What is it about career development in Singapore that makes it so awesome? Like there really is something happening in the professional identity and the services that are being delivered in your country. What's the secret ingredient that y'all have going on?
Wow, that's a very good question, Brian. Let me see if I could get this right. You know, it's the secret success, I would say, that is for our readers, if you have read our paper, career development is a very new thing in Singapore. In fact, we are less than 10 years old to that. But when we were doing our paper, we dug time. We went through the corridors of time, and we learned a lot of things. And career development, as we may fancy it, actually started as early as 1970s. Gosh, I mean, I wasn't even born yet. and along the way, the government is trying to figure out how do we best serve our people with career development and vocational psychology. I mean, basically, this is, you know, as most of our readers know, it's just a science of how people decide and choose work and fit work into their life. Now, we didn't really roll out career development broadly into Singapore until 2014 via the Skills Future framework. So the Skills Future movement. It is collectively led first by the Ministry of Education, and it worked its way down into the entire workforce. So if you ask me, it is first, I think there is a visionary leader leading this entire trust. And our ministers then who conceptualized this Skills Future thing, they embedded educational and career guidance as one of the key milestones in this entire movement. And this movement today, since it was launched, is really almost 5 years old. And because of this movement, not only is it what, although it started in school, it actually proliferated in our entire continuing education sector, our entire employment facilitation landscape before we really go on high booster on a career development in within. And you know, more importantly is I think the union, the education system, they all came together collectively under the common vision. Is that and the government said this is that if we do not collectively come together and if we do not adopt a spirit of attitude of lifelong learning, you know, not only do education may not reach its fullest potential, our human capital, our only natural resources, we may never realize the fullest potential for the next 50 years of our Singapore's generation.
And so I think what every listener could recognize is that just having government programs and direction is not enough to build something of impact. Mm. And I know in the article that you recognize two early pioneers who have been responsible yes. for training probably almost every career practitioner in Singapore. Could maybe each of you take one and talk about these first pioneers and master trainers?
We really want to pay tribute, you know, to these two visionaries who really had the courage to say that, okay, career development must happen in Singapore and we must train a group of people who are strong enough to do it. And we want to put this on record. We want to pay tribute to Wong Sing Chi as well as Han. Without these two people, there is no way we would be who we are today in terms of career development. I have no idea how they actually went to the various ministries to get approval, to get funding, or to even attract people to say that, hey, we've got to train you in career development. We are so nascent, you know, in career development. But they were the ones who were brave enough to say that we have to do something about this. So to Sing Chi and Juan, you know, you're the heroes. Thank you so much.
And, you know, if I may add, you know, it's really important that for Sing Chi and Han to know this is that, you know, when the Workforce Development Association, which is my organization, then we have been renamed and reconstituted. It was because it was them who first worked with the agency to introduce career development into the public employment services. And that is where things really took off. So Sing Chi and Han helped the government, the partner, and help us to stimulate this entire sector. And they, and Brian, you're so right. I think I believe the first 100 career practitioners were trained by them. And it is through them. And Sing Chi was telling me when she was my trainer, by the way, in 2013, March 2013, 21st. I remember on that day, that was my first day of training with her. And she told me this. She said to me and the class is that she chanced upon the NCDA conference in the US. I forgot which year was it, which state. And she realized that this is something that could do so much for the people of Singapore. And when she took up the training, the facilitating career development, then when she came to Singapore, she wrote it out. She worked with us. And we realized that this is the missing piece to just good old fashioned job matching, trait and factor sort of approach. Because we learn to view our people not just as a mere job title. We learn to see them as individuals' lives, who and individuals' challenges, the unique difference in individual life and the aspiration that they want to. So that really kickstarted the boosting rocket, I call it, of career development in Singapore.
Yeah. And the exciting thing for me as an observer who you know, has the pleasure of spending time with everyone that we're talking about here on this podcast is that, you know, the person who breaks the ice, the pioneer, basically just sets the table for other people to prepare the meal. And I can just imagine how proud Han and Xingqi are of the emerging leaders like the two of you, and the future possibilities of career development in Singapore. Because, you know, when we start something, when we pioneer something, our authentic expectation is that we get to witness the people who make it even better than we could have, because our task was to get it started, right? That's the first task. But for what it truly becomes to reach its potential, that relies on this next generation that I'm so happy to get to know the two of you as part of and to get to watch your work. So last question, and because I'm trying to bring some structure to these podcasts, is about the methods that you used. And so when you sat down with this task, and as Jeremiah was just saying, you know, some of what we wrote about was before I was born. How is it, you know, if someone in another country, member country of APCDA, wanted to do a similar study of their own country, could you just sort of walk through a couple of the steps that you took or the steps that you took to create this article?
I would say what we did was, especially when there was some, you know, historical information that we had to verify, we actually went to do primary research. We interviewed, you know, people who've walked those paths. So other than, you know, reaching out into books and all, it helped that we had James, who's actually in the union and, you know, part of the N2C and the E2I, the Employability and Employment Institute. And he also checked with his bosses. Yeah, Gerald and Jeremiah and Andrew also checked with their bosses. Yeah, and we also had someone in, you know, who helped us with the education and career guidance information. So we put everything together. We did primary research, and very importantly, we also made sure that, you know, there were a few pairs of eyes that looked at the paper. For example, Xingqi and Han, you know, we consulted them as well.
Yeah.
That was important, yeah, to us, that we wanted to make sure that, you know, this was factual. Yeah.
And so the two sort of techniques there that I'm hearing are is one, making sure that you have complete representation. Right. So if you're talking about something like this in a country, it would have been less than genuine to not include the trade unions or to not include the government organizations. So when we're looking at sort of a review of this nature, we want to make sure that we're honoring all of the components or all of the major components.
Yeah, that's right.
And then the second thing you said is similar to qualitative research, to the idea of a validity check. And so you constructed this historical piece, but you ran it past the two preeminent people that were there, that witnessed that history, to sort of check the validity of what it is that you did. And so for me, again, that's the difference between other writing and then writing for a science, an academic journal. To add to this, to the body of science. And so my hope is that people listen to this podcast and think to themselves, I could do this in my country too. I could do this in Malaysia or China or Pakistan or Australia or Korea. And so I thank you both for taking that leap and hitting the trampoline and coming back to an amazing lead article in our journal. And just want you both to know how much I appreciate having both of you in my lives. It's just a joy to work with both of you.
You too, Brian.
You know, you've been like a mentor to all of us, just like Roberta. Yeah, just like Xingqi and Han, you know, we've been students of giants. So thank you for your hearts for us.
Yeah.
All right. And so I got to do a podcast host thing here. So this will end our second episode. Please download. Rate, 5-star ratings are awesome, and share this to your network so that we can continue to spread the science behind career development to the world. Until next time, Brian Hutchison signing off.